You don't have to go very far in public these days to see the posture of the modern American. Head bent toward the ground, one arm up, with that hand holding the smartphone that connects the owner to the wired world. It's all there, phone and text and email and internet, all in one handy device. Even people who poo-poo smartphones may spend time at a computer keyboard, web surfing, is that still a term? And checking email and spending time on Facebook. Many of us live on our screens. Today's guest pushed herself away from those screens for a whole month. Christina Crook writes of her experience in The Joy of Missing Out, Finding Balance in a Wired World. Christina Crook is a Canadian writer, prose and poetry, and journalist, and the creator of the project Letters from a Luddite, her first major fast from the wired world. Christina, thanks for joining us on The Exchange.
Thanks for having me.
So what made you disconnect in the first place?
I was feeling like, you know, my email box, my social media feeds, they were beginning to own me, that I didn't have a handle on the input that was coming at me all of the time. And there was a couple relationships in particular that I was noticing were shifting, and I wasn't really paying too much attention to. And those are people that weren't on social media. I couldn't check in with them just by seeing what they posted online, and I wasn't reaching out to them the same way that I used to before I was online as much as I used to. So those were kind of the things that were drawing my attention to this idea of stepping away and figuring out what kind of person and also what kind of parent — I've got three young kids — I would be if I stepped away from the internet for that long.
So the people you needed to get a hold of who were not online, were they just older, or just computer refuseniks, or what was their story?
a bit of a combination. Yeah, one was my dad, who actually is fully integrated online now, but at the time he wasn't. He was the one person that I only connected to face to face with, or over the phone. And then I have one brother who just sort of missed the window on being online at all, and he just feels no need for it. So those are two people in particular that were not online for various reasons.
It does seem fascinating. I don't know if this happens to you too, but the people who, once they discover texting, it's like that's the end of voice calls for them. You can call their phone over and over, but they will only text you back.
Yeah. It's true. There's been a big shift in that for sure. I have people in my life that are the same.
So, Christina, lots of people seem to have love-hate relationships with their electronic gadgets. Is that true of you, too?
I would say absolutely. I love and hate it. I said at the start of my fast that I was both totally obsessed and completely bored with the internet. You know, I love it and I hate it. I love that it connects me to a sister that lives in Australia, a sister that lives in Las Vegas with her family. I love that I'm able to file stories over email in literally 0 seconds flat. But I don't like that it's quite mind-numbing, a lot of the information that I'm inputting all the time. I don't like that allows me to have sort of this buffer between me and the people in my life, where sometimes I need to push out and be a bit more intimate with them in terms of being vulnerable. It's definitely a love-hate relationship.
You've introduced me to a couple of terms I had just heard recently, inbox zero being one of them. Is this sort of like a holy grail for people trying to manage their work email in particular?
Yeah. I don't know who coined that term, but yeah, it's this mythological idea of being able to process every email that comes in your box every day, and that's pretty difficult.
It is, and it's interesting to watch how workflow has changed over the years. I know I've worked with some people who thought that once email got established, that their job basically was to sit there and respond to emails all day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's been a huge shift. I mean, I've got my partner, he is on work calls all day, so it's sort of the same where he's blocked from, 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. on calls and email, and he can't actually get to any of the real projects he's supposed to be doing. You know, it's meetings and it's emails and these technologies, which promised to give us back so much more time, have actually sucked us dry in the time department. So it's, I think people are trying to figure out a way professionally and personally to sort of reclaim some space and some time for some different thinking and for getting into other projects.
You start the book, The Joy of Missing Out, with a vignette of people enjoying the silence of a power failure. Is this something that really happened, or is it an imaginary sort of thing?
It really happened. I live in Toronto. We've got a really bad grid here. I'm from Vancouver originally, but and I don't remember any power outages when I grew up. But over here, for some reason, it goes down quite a lot, and I think it's in the summer. the summer and the winter seem to be the worst times when the power use is high. And I describe this story of a family that a power outage happens, and all of a sudden they strike a match, and then they light this magical thing called a candle, and the family had to gather around that candle because it was the only light they had in the home, and they sort of follows them a bit through a 24-hour period and the things that they did together. Because they didn't really have much else to do. They didn't have television. They didn't have power at home. And so we can actually find a lot of joy when we have those modern conveniences taken away, at least for a short period of time.
Yeah, when you're not all looking at screens, you certainly can look at each other. And there is an extended riff in the beginning of The Joy of Missing Out about faces. And it seems like we are not spending as much time looking into each other's faces as we once were. And there's other, you bring in lots of other voices and lots of other work in the book. I should point that out. But it seems like we're beginning to lose the ability to read other people.
We are. And the point that I make in the early parts of the book are that, you know, from infancy, the eyes of infants seek out the eyes of other humans. We're designed from the get-go to seek out faces and eyes and facial expression. And, you know, we learn in high school biology that 90% of communication is nonverbal. But it seems like in the span of, you know, 10 years, we've all sort of decided that the nonverbal stuff is not that important, and that, you know, we can communicate all we need to with a text. Well, God knows there are a lot of misunderstood texts and emails that are traded back and forth daily all over the world. And that's because people really are designed to communicate with their hands. You know, I'm using my hands right now. I have emotion on my face as I'm speaking with you, and you can only hear only so much of that because I'm not in front of you. So, I think it's really important to pay attention to the fact that we're physical beings, and a lot of our communication is not happening in that very physical way.
And you couldn't hear my face smile in return to what you were saying there.
Exactly.
So. More from Christina Crook coming up. Her book is The Joy of Missing Out, Finding Balance in a Wired World. We will rejoin the interview here on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Canadian writer and journalist Christina Cook switched from FOMO, fear of missing out, to JOMO. Her book is The Joy of Missing Out, Finding Balance in a Wired World. In it, she recounts the 31 days she spent away from screens and the internet. That's an electronic fast few people can imagine in today's world. Let's get back to it with a reminder there are phone calls and emails from the original broadcast in 2015, but we can't take any new contacts today. It sounds like, Christina, your major concern is that we potentially atrophy as human beings by being screen dependent.
Yeah, there is that concern, and it's being studied more and more. When we depend on search engines to remember information rather than, you know, sitting for a minute, you know, or even 10 seconds to try and find that information somewhere in the far recesses of our heads, we're not building that actual muscle, which is the brain. There definitely are concerns about relying too heavily on the internet and Google in particular.
We really can get pretty much anything on a smartphone these days. Are you still surprised by it all?
I'm not anymore surprised by it. I am surprised by the stuff that people keep themselves busy with. I just don't know where people find the time or why certain apps or games interest them. But no, I'm not too surprised anymore by what's coming out.
You draw a parallel in the book between the Segway and our use of mobile devices. What is that?
Well, you know, it just kind of dawned on me in a moment, the Segway, I'm not sure if everyone knows what it is, but it was this two-wheeled transport system that was supposed to revolutionize cities and really the globe in terms of people wouldn't have to walk anymore. We just have these paths where people could drive them around, and that was going to be the way of the future, except for the fact that people were made to walk, right? Like we were given 2 feet to use. And I guess the parallel I'm trying to make is the people really are the ultimate tablet. You know, we're the ultimate communications device. We communicate better than anything out there in the world. We can communicate so much with our facial expression, like we described already, our body language, our words. So why sort of reinvent the wheel, I guess, is the point I was trying to make.
From the research you read from other people, does it appear that that people are in fact turning to devices more than being with each other? I mean, and there's lots of anecdotal stuff, and everybody can talk about like riding a bus and seeing the kids sitting next to each other, not talking to each other because they're talking to other people through screens. But I mean, is there information about how dependent people are getting and whether they are in fact eschewing face to face relationships for the screen?
I think that, again, we're still in the early stages of all of this, so the longitudinal studies just simply aren't there. But I think, you know, in my own life, in, you know, everything I see around me and what people are sharing with me, I think that people are spending time inside. I kind of laugh sometimes. I tell the story of an Amish couple, our family, in the book as well. I don't sort of focus too much on the Amish, but I have this one bit, and I think that the Amish like get it on more than like the average couple because they don't have Netflix. Like they don't have, there's not a lot else to do. It's dark, you know, and I think that that's kind of what generally is happening in the culture. People are going out less in the evenings. I mean, even with my book launches, I'm like, come on, people, one night without Netflix, you know, people will sign up and say yes online, right? But to actually get out the door, it requires a lot of effort.
It does indeed. Now, you walk us through various periods in history in the book, and I'm curious to know how universal in each was the concern that technology would turn us into something different, which is the concern we're talking about now.
You mean with other technologies that have come out in the past?
Right. In fact, I think I remember reading something somewhere about people being concerned about these young people walking around with books in front of them. They'll just crash into things.
Exactly. Yeah, there's been concerns with every new technology that has come out, their communication technology and technology otherwise. You know, Aristotle even had some choice words about the danger of writing things down, you know, that the loss of oral culture, sharing stories, remembering stories and songs. So there's always been sort of these warning flags in a culture about the newest things. So I realize that I am sort of in that group of people. But I think that those voices and conversations are important every step of the way. And, you know, and that helps us as a culture, as a human race, you know, figuring out where the balance is, what's beneficial and what's not so beneficial for us.
There's a timeline in the book where you list so a lot of things that have come along and, you know, right from before the Industrial Revolution up to the present day when things were invented and the things that changed in the way we relate to one another and communicate. But alongside that timeline, you are listing the number of definitions of mental illness. What's the purpose there?
You know, it wasn't an original idea. It came from a media theorist from NYU named Dr. Reed Shushart, and from a series of talks that he did. And I just found it interesting that, you know, the DSM, the actual record of all the different mental health diagnoses, completely exploded with the advent of the telephone and then, of course, through to now with the internet. And there's a variety of reasons for that. But, you know, for me, it really comes down to we're fragmented. You know, our attention spans, our relationships, everything is faster. You know, it makes sense to me that there would be a rise in mental health diagnoses with the advent of these new technologies that maybe we don't really have a handle on yet.
Is there some sense that you discovered in research that maybe our brains are not quite set up to do the kinds of things we're throwing at them now, that we might still have evolved to the point of like, yes, we can guide a horse down a field pulling a plow, but
right,
haven't quite gotten up to all the blinking lights and buttons around us?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then we create all the buttons and all the blinking stuff and all of the technology, and then we realize we can't keep up, so then we try to make us keep up, you know? And I think that that's sort of the state that we're in right now is we're here, we have all this information, we as humans are somehow not keeping up, we're not doing, you know, we should do better. So we need to figure out more technologies to make that possible for us to keep up with the speed of the internet in particular. And Google's, you know, at the forefront of those technologies that they're trying to develop to make the human brain move more quickly and to more integrate the human and the computer. And that's concerning to me because I think that we are human, that there is some integrity to our design as human beings and that we should live in light of that. And if our brains have those limitations, then perhaps that's purposeful. Perhaps we should have some limits on what we can think about and what we can do in a given moment.
Christina, there's a great question heading one of the sections of the book, which is, what has the internet given me? How do you answer that question yourself?
Mm-hmm. It has given me an amazing ability to connect with my brothers and sisters, in particular, all over the world.
You have seven or what is it?
What's that?
How many? You got a bunch of brothers and sisters.
I have a bunch, yes. I am one of eight kids. It's a bit of a mishmash family, but we've all been together since we were very young. So I mentioned a sister in Las Vegas and a sister in Australia, and the rest of my, all my brothers are actually on the West Coast. And I have a sister in Oregon, actually. So, so we're all spread out. So, of course, the internet is our way of staying connected to one another when we're not physically together. But we're actually going on a huge family trip next month where we're all going to be together in the same place. I mean, the quality of our time together during that week is going to far outweigh anything throughout the year on the internet. But that's a huge thing for me, is being able to FaceTime, being able to email and call my brothers and sisters. The other thing is, I actually had to file two stories offline while I was doing my 31-day fast, and that was horrible. I had to save the article on a USB stick, write a letter, put it in a mail or envelope, mail it. One of them got lost. It cost me $45 to do 2-day service. And I was just like, the internet is amazing. I could file my story for free in 0 seconds, you know. So it's an unbelievable tool. And so those are some of the ways that I use the net for good.
Makes so many things possible. Christina Crook is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, Canadian author and journalist. And her latest book is The Joy of Missing Out, Finding Balance in a Wired World, about 31 Days Without Screens. First up is Jamie in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Yes, good morning, Jeffrey.
Howdy.
Good morning, guest. I figured I'd start with a joke. Stop me if you've heard this one. How can you tell that a person is computer illiterate?
How?
There's eraser marks on their screen.
Ah, okay, thanks.
Anyway, ma'am, I wanted to ask you this. I'm 59 years old. I'm a deliberate technology curmudgeon. I actually do write cards and letters and mail them and such. I just wanted to ask you what your take is on the on Google's Google Glasses. And secondly, a question. Do you know if, during your research, whether there are any 12-step programs for people who are way too into their emails and their text messaging and such? And, Jeffrey, I'll take the responses off of the phone if I can.
All right. Thanks, Jamie. Appreciate that. So, Google Glass first up, and then 12-step programs for netaholics.
Mm-hmm. So, yes, Google Glass. So, I did a TEDx talk, and I actually talked about Google Glass in particular, and it's on the market, but it's not wildly popular yet, mostly because of the price point. But my concern with Google Glass is the fact that they could be shooting a video or checking their stock portfolio while looking at you, and you wouldn't know. If we really want to know if the person is paying attention to us when we're meeting with them in person, then I think that just like we would hopefully silence and put our smartphones aside when we meet with people in person, that people with Google Glass would do the same thing. So I don't necessarily have a problem with the technology, but it does cause concerns for intimacy. I mean, if you are meeting with someone and they really are looking at you, but they're not looking at you at all, that's concerning to me. I think that's going to cause some pretty major problems in terms of interpersonal relationships.
Is it terribly different from the people who wear the Bluetooth earphones, though, and you're never quite sure if they're talking to you or the person they can hear in the other ear?
Those people just look crazy. Sorry.
You don't go as far down the Google Glass line, though, as to use the nasty name that has developed for them?
What is it? I think I heard it, but I can't remember.
It's glass holes.
Oh, right. Mm-hmm. Yes.
So, no, not that far down.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So the other question was about 12-step programs. Jamie was interested to know if you've heard of anything where there people are trying to get rid of their addiction to screens.
I have heard. There is one. There is basically an AA for people that, identify as being addicted to technology or the internet in particular. I forget the name of it, but I think it's, digital, tech addicts Anonymous or something. I don't think it's really mainstream quite yet. But the big thing that's cropping up are these digital detox camps all over the world, where basically you pay a premium to leave your phone at home, and it's basically like summer camp for adults. I think it's a great reset. I think you can also do it without paying extra money, you know, by going on a holiday and leaving your laptop and your cell phone at home. But I think that those, you know, those weeks set apart to realize that you're not the center of the universe, that the world keeps on turning without your tweets and likes, and, you know, that there's a lot of life just right in front of you. I think that those trips are a great idea.
Well, before we get too far into the details of your 31-day fast, I mean, did you do this while you were at home, or did you do it on a vacation or something?
Nope, I did it at home.
Okay, we'll get the details in a moment. I want to take another call here. Let's go to Grumpy John in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Christina Crook. Her book is The Joy of Missing Out.
Thanks very much, Jeffrey. Hi, Christina.
Hi.
I want to talk about two very significant drawbacks to our screen culture as I see it. Number one is our nature perspective. You know, the nature videos are absolutely fascinating. I mean, where else are you going to be able to see a hummingbird do a 180 as it chases a bug? It's astounding. However, it does mess with your perspective, because you're looking at a stellar jay and a grizzly bear, and they're right there in your screen. The nature experience is missing. I was driving through the Scott Valley, and I saw these big brown birds up ahead. As I got closer, I was able to tell that they were eagles. And I said, I wonder why they're called golden eagles. And then when he flew, the sheen from the sun on his feathers just transformed this brown bird into this moving golden experience. You just can't get that from a screen. And then taking it one step further, it is modifying our perceptions, our very brains, because if you say, let's use our imagination, kids, picture a forest, for instance. Jeffrey, instead of picturing a forest, we are picturing a two-dimensional picture of a three-dimensional object. We imagine a screen forest, not the actual forest. And I think these are very disturbing consequences of our screen life. Thank you.
Thanks for the perspective, Grumpy John. Thoughts from you, Christina?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think the nature deficit in particular, I'm quite interested in. My daughter, who's 5 years old at this very moment, is actually at nature March break camp. It's spring break here, and they're outside for 6 hours down by a river here in Toronto, exploring, harvesting, doing everything outdoors. And I can juxtapose that with my daughter watching The Lorax, which is a Dr. Seuss movie that came out 2 years ago. And in one primary scene in the movie, which I actually talk about in my book, they plant a seed, and then within about 10 seconds, an entire tree had grown. So when my daughter planted a seed maybe a few months later that she'd gotten from a birthday party, she expected it to grow immediately, you know, because she saw in The Lorax that you plant a seed and then up it goes, which of course it doesn't. So it's completely, you know, that you know, what we see on the screen completely shapes our perception of what we think happens in the real world. And I completely agree that not just children, but as adults, there's huge studies done on the stress reduction of being in nature. I mean, even when I go down there and drop my daughter off, I spend, you know, the first 15 minutes with their group, and I linger with our younger kids. And, you know, it just resets me. We were watching the clouds, and it's just beautiful and refreshing. And I think it's extremely important as adults and children to be immersed in nature for large portions of our weeks. And And that is something we're missing out on simply because we only have so much time. And if we're spending them in front of screens, then we are not spending them in nature.
I'm not sure how small screen dependent this is, though, because something that, that Grumpy John was talking about reminded me of my own experience the first time I actually was able to videotape a bald eagle. In the wild was realizing, oh, they don't move in slow motion like we're always seeing in the movies. You know, they don't have the music with the brass bands and the national anthem playing behind them. So that took some getting used to. The eagle's just flapping away, mm-hmm. trying to get to a tree mm-hmm. on the other side of a lake. So, you know, it doesn't necessarily have to be a small screen that gets between you and nature.
That's true. And I think the other point I'd want to make is that, you know, when kids are first or primarily exposed to nature on the screen, like he was describing, it has a speed and gloss to it that simply is not true of the real world. So when they actually do get out in nature, even in their backyard where they've got a sticker and they're poking around, it seems boring, right? Because it's not moving quickly. It does not have any gloss. The color is muted. And so I think that's why I really am advocating in my book for our primary time and energy to be spent in the real world and then sort of our online one to be secondary.
There's a priority order to consider. It works for Christina Crook, the author of The Joy of Missing Out, Finding Balance in a Wired World. More on her month away from screens and the internet coming up. The interview continues here on the Jefferson Exchange in 1:15. It's the final segment of today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Christina Crook is a Canadian journalist who turned her reportorial skills on herself by pushing away from the internet and all the screens that connect to it for an entire month. Her book is The Joy of Missing Out, Finding Balance in a Wired World. The interview is from 2015, so we're not taking any new phone calls or emails today. We were just talking about the screens and nature and the importance of getting kids out to nature. Your daughter, you mentioned, is at a March break camp in Toronto this week, spending time down by the river. What do you do in the way of managing screen time for your three kids?
You know, we're not a hard set rule. You know, this is the exact time you watch screens, though I do think that there's some benefit to that. We're kind of an ebb and flow family. So, you know, our kids do watch, you know, shows every day probably, but not for long periods of time, maybe for half an hour. You know, and for me, it's all about making life work, you know, I, as a parent, because it's an extremely difficult job. But I know that when I take the time to stop, you know, with my constant to-do list, because Lord knows it will never end, the to-do list of work and home, and sit with them and I'm present to them, that it requires a lot more of me. You know, it's very easy to plop them down in front of a show, but it requires much more for me to stop and be present with them. And that's the harder work of being a parent, but that's what we signed up for. I try to keep them away from the screens as much as possible. The springtime helps with that. It's been a long winter. But for me, it's all about finding the things that they love to do and engaging them more in those things. And then the screen time isn't really a fight.
So during the time of your internet fast in a house with a husband and three kids, I mean, how did the other members of the family approach their screen time?
My husband still had it for work, but it did definitely impact him also because, you know, I couldn't be present when internet-related things were happening. I couldn't be participating in watching a show on Netflix or anything with him. And for the kids in particular, it probably impacted them more than him. You know, I couldn't put on any shows for them online at all. So I had a very limited selection of DVDs, and they definitely got a bit boring by the end. But that was okay because we got busy with doing other things. I figured out ways to engage them with even the regular tasks of the day, like doing dishes or cooking. So it required more creativity on my part, but in the long term, it actually honed some new skills for me and for them and got us doing other things.
We have another call. Here's Tony in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Christina Crook.
Okay. I don't have a computer. With all the ID theft, I wouldn't want one.
Mm-hmm.
I don't text, but I do watch television on Saturday morning because they've got a lot of animal shows. I can see various animals in countries I'm never going to go to. And yet I can step out my back door, and if I was lucky, I could actually see squirrels, deers, wild turkey, stuff like that before the poachers and the shooters decided to chase them away.
So the point being that, you can get it, I mean, you're using nature both in person and through the TV.
Yeah, but, you know, TV is supposed to be for entertainment when you're unable to do something else. There is some people that are unable to last long periods. They're old enough and handicapped enough, last long periods outside. So it's something that they can do while they're doing handicraft.
All right, so some benefits to screens for sure. Thanks for that, Tony. Appreciate it. The process of planning your internet fest, Christina. How much thought did you have to give it? You've got a long section here where you go into the meaning of fast in a lot of religious and spiritual contexts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in terms of preparation, I guess there's two sides to that. You know, preparing myself mentally and maybe emotionally to disengage, and also just the practical steps. The practical steps involved getting a map book, because I couldn't Google map anymore. That was probably one of the hardest things for me while I was offline. I had to save important phone numbers that I would normally Google for. I had to notify people. I had to set up an automatic email responder, et cetera. But I had been thinking about doing something of this nature for quite a long time, and I just decided that a January first start was a great time to start. And I just dug in. I just flipped it off, and I went through the normal couple of days of withdrawal symptoms. You know, I had set up a blog, you mentioned it at the start of the show, called Letters from a Luddite. That was the name of the experiment, and I set up a blog, and the editor in me wanted to make a tweak to the original post, and of course I couldn't go back and do anything about it, and I found that quite frustrating at first, but I just decided, you know, I have to let this go, and that's really what it was. It was an exercise in just having to let go of what was happening on the internet and what was, you know, what emails I was getting, and so that was a bit of my experience.
So your phone was off limit, but were you off limit from phones to use for voice calls?
No, I could use my phone. I kept that both for safety because of my kids and also just a bit for sanity to be able to, you know, reach out to my parents and stuff like that. But I could use my phone as a phone, but that was it.
All right, so you turned the data off, didn't use the internet, et cetera. Okay.
Yeah.
Which apparently proved to be an issue at one point. Didn't you lock your phone in the house with one of the kids?
Yes. I did. My baby, our youngest was asleep in a baby swing, and I accidentally locked my phone and my keys. I don't even know how that's possible, but I did during the fast inside, and I was in a complete and utter panic. No, I did have my phone. I locked my keys inside the house. I had my phone, but it had no data, so I couldn't Google for a locksmith or whatever I would need. So I had to scan the neighborhood to see who was home. Our immediate neighbors who were the closest to were out, but I saw a car in the driveway a few doors down, and so me and my other kid ran down there, and luckily our friend was working from home that day in her house coat and let us in, and she called a locksmith, and we got sorted out. But it definitely does require you to reach out to other people for help in those moments, and does make things a bit more difficult.
And most happy the baby was still asleep when you got back in the
He
house.
Was still asleep. That is very important for everyone to know. He was safe and sleeping still when I got in, but I was a mess.
So did you get to know neighbors better? I mean, did you meet more people on the street? Did you go for walks? Did you do things you wouldn't normally do during the fast?
Yeah, like one of the main things for me was I was just moving more slowly. My head was more clear. I wasn't running from to-do list to to-do list. I wasn't doing as much work online. I mean, as much work, period, because I wasn't online. So I was walking more slowly back and forth from the schoolyard, stopping to chat with people. And people were interested in the experiment. So, you know, I got to chatting with neighbors more and more about that. And then I met the neighbor that I actually knocked on the door of. I had never met her before. So we became friends through that experience. So, yeah, I definitely got to know my neighbors. I relied on them way more. You know, I had to ask the neighbor next door for a pizza recommendation instead of, you know, checking Yelp or some other search engine for it. So I needed the people in front of me.
We have an email here from Nancy No Town Given. She says, I'm concerned about excess, about technology addiction society fails to address. It is frightening that iPads are being used as babysitters, that parents seem to focus more on their screens than their children. That from Nancy again. So your thoughts on that one?
Mm-hmm. You know, I am very slow to make judgments on any parent because being a parent is really hard. And there are times when my kids do sit in front of an iPad and watch a show, but they don't do it when we're out to dinner. They don't do it in the car. Like, there's certain places where we just as a family have decided that these are times we're going to be together as a family. So my kids have never watched a screen in a stroller. And I do find those things concerning because, you know, whether it's the nanny or it's the mom or the dad or the any caregiver, you know, who's walking along with a kid in a stroller, I mean, that's, or even in the car, that's an opportunity to be talking and engaging. It requires more work, but it's awesome. We were driving back from Niagara Falls, and it was an extremely long drive, and it was snowing, and the highway was a disaster, and, you know, but we didn't have any video player in the car, and what did we do? We played I Spy. We came up with some ridiculous game as a family to play together, and that engaged us all together. So it requires more work, but in the end, it connects us more deeply than it would be if we were all individually looking at our screens, which really isn't connecting at all.
You mentioned already the briefly in passing having to file via the mail. So how did you write anything during the course of that month?
I wrote it. I could use my computer to write. I didn't almost at all. But for those two articles, I wrote them on my computer without any internet access. So my FAST was all about the internet. Mm-hmm. So it's pretty limiting. So there was a person that I interviewed who had recommended a book for the piece. And I couldn't, of course, just go online and Google for a quote from the book. But sort of through a chain of connections, a friend of mine through church actually had a copy of it, and he drove it over to my house, and I ended up reading that entire book instead of just grabbing a quote online. So it was just a different way of gathering information. I had the library. I could get books from the library and articles and stuff like that. So, it was a lot more tricky, that's for sure. But it also engaged me in a different way because normally if I was grabbing a quote from a particular article or piece that someone had mentioned, I would have just, you know, gone online and grabbed a quote. But I actually sunk my teeth into this particular book, and I would never have read it otherwise. And it was a wonderful piece of nonfiction.
So how often were there postings to Letters from a Luddite?
Postings? Yeah. Oh, so what happened was, I wrote a letter each day on an old typewriter to my friend Marissa in Vancouver. So she's one of my oldest, dearest friends, and I wanted to sort of log what I was experiencing offline. I'd been gathering all these news clippings for quite a number of years, actually, but sort of the shifts in the culture with smartphones and the internet. So each day I wrote a letter, and I enclosed clippings usually each day, and I mailed those by snail mail across the country, and then she opened the mail and then scanned those letters and then posted them to the blog. So there was a blog. It was not kept up by me, but it was not so well. It didn't go so well because things happen in the real world. You know, it's not like an email where it just goes straight to your inbox. Mail can sometimes take a bit of a strange route. So letter number 17 would come before letter number 4. It was all over the place. So it wasn't a very seamless experiment, but it was pretty funny.
I was going to ask you if Canada Post is any better than the U.S. Postal Service. It sounds like it's about the same.
Oh, let's not talk about that.
Fair enough. Were there days and periods, Christina, when you felt like an addict in withdrawal?
Were there days where I felt like I was going through withdrawal?
Yeah.
There was one particular, definitely the first couple of days, I was jonesing for being online. I wanted to know what was happening. And then I actually got quite sick with a cold in sort of the middle of the month. And there was one day, and it's actually in one of the letters on the blog, about the fact that I was desperately wanting Netflix to put on a show for my kid because I couldn't, I was just so exhausted, and she was so done with her little collection of DVDs. So that was one particular day where I was going through a bit of withdrawal symptoms. But, you know, it's a lot easier to be completely without the internet than it is to daily choose what you're going to pay attention to and what you're not going to pay attention to. That's been my experience.
So since you have come back off the fast, I mean, have you gone through the, have you basically gone back to doing everything you did before, or is it more mindful now when you choose to go on the internet?
Yeah, it's way more mindful. I mean, the biggest shift for me is viewing the internet as a tool. You know, it is a tool there to help us access information, connect us to people. But it's a tool, ultimately, and so I try and use it as such. And one key thing that I do before I actually open up my laptop is I write a list of the things that I need to get done online on a piece of paper, and I try and get through that list as quickly as possible and then close my computer and move on to other things. So I also didn't reinstall social media apps on my phone. That was a huge thing. I think if people feel like they're and know that they're wasting a lot of time on social media, that they should get rid of it off on their phones, because it's just too good. It's too enticing, you know, to not do it. So that's another big thing. And then when I first came back online, I unsubscribed from all unnecessary email clutter. So all those emails that you delete multiple times a day, I spent the time, it was probably 3 or 4 hours, where I just went through and unsubscribed systematically from all that stuff. And those changes really have helped me.
Wow, 3 or 4 hours. Okay, that's what we have to look for if we want to do the unsubscribe thing. All right, well, a very interesting experience, and thanks for sharing it with us in the book, The Joy of Missing Out, Finding Balance in a Wired World. Christina Crook, thanks for joining us on The Exchange today.
Thanks so much for having me.